Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And we have a special – well, we have a special edition because it is Ascension Thursday today. And I guess if you don't get to call is special, then because we're not taking any callers.
Well,
this.
It's special. It's a holy day for the church. In some places, it's a holy day of obligation, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yep.
But it also is a celebration of our Lord's ascension into heaven. And in honor of that, at Catholic Answers, we have the day off. So we're not in the studio live today. We're pre-recording this show.
And that is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy. How's it going, Cy?
I'm having a really good Ascension Thursday.
Good.
In the future.
Proleptically.
Yeah. Well, very nice. Okay, let's talk a little bit about that. So the Feast of the Ascension, we celebrate that moment where Christ departs from his
earthly life.
And so you mentioned about the Holy Day of Obligation thing.
Yeah.
It has been for a long time. Ascension Thursday is a Holy Day of Obligation. In some places, it's now moved to Sunday.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah. So if you look in the Code of Canon Law, the Church has about 10 Holy Days of Obligation that are part of universal law. But the Code also gives the local bishops' conferences the ability to adapt that list to the needs of their own nations. And so you'll get different Holy Days in different countries. Like, for example, in Ireland, St. Patrick's Day is a Holy Day of Obligation because he was, you know, the apostle to the Irish.
Yes.
So it's a very significant holiday there. In the United States, we actually have more holy days than a lot of countries. A lot of countries have said that based on conditions of modern life, having a holy day fall during the week makes it difficult for their people to get to church. And so in some countries, they have as few as two. Typically, it'll be Christmas and one of the Marian's holidays like New Year's Day, Mary, Mother of God. Here in the United States, we have more than that. Our bishops have kept more than that. But they have allowed the different ecclesiastical provinces in the U.S. Now, that's a group of dioceses that are located adjacent to each other. They've allowed the different ecclesiastical provinces to decide, are they going to have Ascension Thursday celebrated on a Thursday, in which case it's a holy day of obligation, or are they going to transfer it to the next following Sunday, in which case it's also a holy day of obligation because every Sunday is a holy day of obligation. Holy Day of Obligation being a day that Catholics are expected, among other things, to attend Mass unless they have a good reason not to. So here in the United States, the bishops made that determination. If 2/3 of the bishops in a province vote to transfer the commemoration of the Ascension to the following Sunday, then that's how that province will do it. And most of the provinces here in the United States have done that. There are some that haven't. Primarily, they are on the East Coast. There's also one in Nebraska that hasn't, but in the rest of the country, in the South and here in the West, the different provinces have voted to celebrate Ascension Thursday on a Sunday, which has kind of rankled some folks because we have a good argument that this event really did happen on a Thursday.
Yeah.
Which is something we can get into.
Okay. All right. But I wonder about this, though. At a certain period, maybe say go back to a Christian country. Let's pick the 1500s or 1400s.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Then these holy days, they would also have been days of rest for people who
yes.
were working on the farm. And mm-hmm. most people worked as labor.
Right.
The vast majority. So for labor, these would have been a day off, really.
Yes.
That included going to Mass. Mm-hmm. But that has a different – because we live in a more secularized – or we live in a secularized society – it has a different you don't get a day off from work.
Right. And that's – I mean typically on Sundays you do in our culture. But but you don't for weekday ones. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of bishops' conferences in different countries have said it's just really hard to get everybody to go to Mass on this day. It's a burden on them because – of it's the middle of the week and they're not getting a day off like mm-hmm. they used to back when there were a lot more holy days.
Yeah, yeah. And so we have to celebrate the Ascension. I mean, it's not kind of the thing where you go, oh, we'll just...
Yeah, it gets celebrated one way or another. It's just a question of, do you do it on Thursday, which is the day that it's argued it historically happened, or do you do it on a Sunday when you have the day off and you're able to get to Mass easier?
Okay, so let's start there then with our discussion of Ascension Thursday. Mm-hmm. How do we know that Christ actually... departed this earth on a Thursday?
Well, it's that timing is based on the Book of Acts. So the four Gospels indicate that Jesus rose from the dead on a Sunday, on the first day of the week, and Luke in the very first chapter of Acts says that Jesus spent 40 days after he rose from the dead being with the disciples and conversing with them and instructing them for their future ministry and so forth. And so people have taken that 40 days and say, okay, if you count forward from Easter by 40 days, you end up on a Thursday. And so that's why it's Ascension Thursday. Now, one, properly speaking, could question that because the ancients often counted inclusively, meaning that they would start the count and they would count parts as wholes, and they would start counts in a way that kind of overlapped. Mm-hmm. So there's a question. I mean, it could be off by a day, but really, I mean, we have a very good argument. This happened on a Thursday, and so that's why we celebrate it historically on a Thursday before the advent of all the complexities of modern scheduling and secular society and so forth.
So then I want to get into a little bit about what happened. So if we think about those 40 days, Christ rises on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
When he rises, his body, if we just talk about his body itself, it's not the same.
It's been upgraded.
It's been okay, it's been upgraded, right. So we use the term glorified body. So when we think of ourselves that someday we'll receive a glorified body.
Right.
And that will come after our death and after we have gone to heaven, right?
It depends. I mean, if you're still alive
at
the time of the second coming, then Scripture says you'll be transformed in a twinkling of an eye. So it won't like you'll be having to watch that little wheel just spin and spin and spin. You'll get the instant upgrade.
Okay. But Christ is glorified from the moment of his resurrection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so why does... I guess what I'm getting at is, so then there's 40 days where he has a glorified body, but he's not
here on earth,
but he's not in heaven.
Right.
Okay. So why does he look the same? I mean, I know that there's some things about sometimes he looks different and all that, but why doesn't he look glorified to them? In other words,
the transfiguration.
That's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. The transfiguration, but now he's not.
Well,
for these 40 days,
when glory can manifest in multiple different ways. One way is by having shining light, and that's the way his glory manifested on the Mount of Transfiguration. There's this bright light, and his clothes are described as being dazzling white. Whiter than any fuller could bleach them. And that's the way his glory manifested on that occasion. But it also manifests in other ways. Really, when we say he had a glorified body, we don't mean he was in heaven all the time.
Okay.
We don't mean he was shining light all the time. We just mean his body had been supernaturalized in a wonderful way by God's grace that enabled multiple different things to happen with it that don't normally happen with bodies. And you mentioned one of them, the fact that he's not recognized by the disciples immediately on all occasions. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of an interesting thought I've had about that. Because in the place where we really get that concept explored is in Luke's gospel on the road to Emmaus. He's in the company of two disciples. We know the name of one of them, Clopas. Mm-hmm. We're not sure about the other one, but Clopas is named. And so presumably he's the primary tradent, the person who passed on this tradition to the church, which is why he gets named. He was the one who was always telling the story afterwards about here's what happened. And so Clopas and a companion are on their way to a town called Emmaus, which is just outside Jerusalem. And Jesus comes up alongside them on the road and walks with them, talks to them. And Luke says their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And that suggests, I mean, if you just take that statement by itself, that suggests to me that this wasn't a case of he had transformed to look like somebody else. It's not like, say, he was a brunette and he was appearing as a blonde. Mm-hmm. It's that there was a problem on their side with their ability to recognize him. And that's actually a known medical condition. It's called prosopagnosia. Prosopon is the Greek word for face. Means not, and gnosis means knowing. So prosopagnosia means not knowing somebody's face. And this is a real medical condition. It's called face blindness in English, where you can see somebody and not recognize them. And people who have this condition medically will have to rely on cues like a person's voice or what they're wearing to figure out who they're talking to, because there's nothing wrong with their eyes. They can see a person's face perfectly fine, but there's something going on in the wiring of their brain where they can't process that information and tie it to a personal identity. And so you could, if you had prosopagnosia, you could be talking to your wife and not realize it.
Yeah.
And so, given that Luke says that their eyes were kept from recognizing him, to me, that sounds like induced prosopagnosia, that God was interfering with their ability to process the information their eyes were giving them. And of course, this is a very interesting and strange thing. Jesus eventually does let them recognize him when he breaks bread with them, but it seems he's being playful here. And showing us, doing something mysterious to convey part of the mystery of God and how God can be alongside of us in everyday life and we don't even recognize it. And so you could look at that as a kind of spiritual lesson he's doing, perhaps through prosopagnosia. I should mention in the longer ending of Mark's gospel, which is the last 12 verses of Mark. It's Mark 16, yeah. 9 through 20. These apparently weren't in the original version of Mark. They're in the canon, but they're not from the original version of Mark, whose ending either was very strange and abrupt or was lost early on. And then another ending was composed that drew together traditions about Jesus from different sources, including Luke. And so one of the things that the longer ending of Mark picks up on, one of the Jesus traditions it includes, is a shortened account of this encounter on the road to Emmaus, where it's recorded in Mark 16 that two of the disciples – it doesn't name Clopas in this case – but two of the disciples had met Jesus appearing in another form. And that could be another way of describing the prosopagnosia issue that they had, or it could mean that he literally changed form, which is actually something you get in some of the apocryphal literature. I forget exactly which work it's in. It might be the Apocryphon of James, but I forget. But in some of the New Testament apocryphal literature, there are additional accounts of what happened during this period between the resurrection and the ascension. And in one of them, it talks about the disciples being out on the Sea of Galilee fishing, and they saw Jesus on the shore. And at first, he looked like – or at one time, he looked like a young man with a short beard. But then they looked again. He looks like an old man with a long flowing beard. And that would suggest an actual shift in form. Not saying that really happened, but it's there in some of the apocryphal literature.
We have to take a break, and more on those 40 days leading up to the ascension. And then we will get into what actually happened at the ascension of our Lord and what it means with Jimmy Akin, our guest. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
We as Catholics need to stand strong, to be prepared to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we as believers are presented with every day. Jimmy Akin is here to help. His innovative new book, A Daily Defense, takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections has recently formed a partnership featuring a dual enrollment program with Franciscan University of Steubenville. Our website is homeschoolconnections.com. We are a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 28:16, the 11 apostles went to Galilee to the mountain to which Jesus had ordered them. When they saw him, he approached them and said, "All power in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I will be with you always until the end of the age." He told them to make disciples through sacrament and word. Notice there is no mention of the Bible here, or anywhere in Scripture for that matter. It was by word of mouth that the church began, and the direct authority he gave it. Eventually, words were written, codified, and compiled into one volume. This he left for his church to do, which it eventually accomplished. Today, he remains with the church and guides it with the same authority he gave it so long ago. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're doing a special broadcast today because it is Ascension Thursday all around the world for Catholics today. Sometimes the celebration or the Mass celebration is moved to Sunday in some places, but everywhere Ascension Thursday is nonetheless acknowledged across the world. And Jimmy, we were talking a little bit about, so Christ rises, immediately has a glorified body. And now I just want to get to you some of the biblical evidence about what happened there.
Okay.
If I read Matthew's gospel, it ends with the Great Commission.
Yes.
I have always assumed, because they're on a mountaintop when that Great Commission is given, myself, mm-hmm. that's the same as the time of the Ascension. Is that a faulty assumption?
Yeah, there's an issue there. So in Matthew's account, now one of the things you find when you read the Gospels is in Mark, when the angels meet the women, they tell the women to go tell the disciples that they're to go to Galilee and meet Jesus in Galilee, because he previously said that he would see them there.
Yeah.
And so they're told to go to Galilee to do this. But then Mark's gospel cuts off suddenly in verse 8, and it actually cuts off in a very strange way, because it's kind of in the middle of a sentence almost. It says that the women fled and didn't speak to anyone, for they were afraid. And the word "for" in Greek is gar. And it's normally not the word you finish a sentence with.
Oh, I see.
But in this case, it just cuts off there.
Right.
And there have been all kinds of speculations about why. One suggestion that has been made is that Mark stopped writing there. He meant to write more and didn't for mm-hmm. some reason. Another suggestion is that he did write more, but the original ending has been lost, had to happen really quickly. In one of the very first few copies that was ever made. Otherwise, yeah. The other copies would have the ending and it would be there. Another theory is that Mark stopped there deliberately in a kind of avant-garde literary move because the women, you know, have now have been told to go tell the message of Jesus. And by suddenly stopping, Mark is kind of throwing that burden on the audience and saying, okay, you audience, now are you going to go tell the message of Jesus to other people? And so there are a bunch of different ideas about what happened. Apparently, and there are several different later endings that were proposed for Mark. There's one called the Frierlogion, which is kind of short. There's a short ending. And then there's the one that became canonical, which is the longer ending with an additional 12 verses. so we have, regardless of exactly what happened and exactly what the original ending of Mark was, you have in the undisputed text, the angels telling the women to get the disciples to go to Galilee to see Jesus. That's what we see in Matthew. Same thing happens. Matthew includes a little bit of extra information because he's like, for example, mentioned the guard that was set over the tomb. So he kind of ties that up with what happened with the guard. But you have the same basic message. The disciples are told to go meet Jesus in Galilee. And so the way Matthew presents it, and I have a personal speculation that if you take out the additional stuff about the guard, you may be left in Matthew pretty much with the original ending of Mark because Matthew follows Mark in 90%. He uses 90% of Mark. And so if Matthew had access to the original ending of Mark, he could have used it in composing the ending of his gospel. And so you may have that same thing. However that may be, in Matthew, the disciples are told to go meet Jesus in Galilee, and that's what they do. So when Jesus is giving them the Great Commission, it's on a mountain in Galilee. Now, if you then flip over and look at the Gospel of Luke, Luke does not record the bit about go to Galilee. Okay. And the reason for that, if you think about it, is pretty straightforward. Luke is planning a sequel. He's planning to write the book of Acts.
Right.
And so in Acts, he knows that he's going to start with the spread of the gospel message from Jerusalem. He even outlines the spread in the very early on in Acts about how the gospel is going to spread beginning at Jerusalem into Judea and Samaria, which was farther away than Judea, and to the ends of the earth. So it's going to – and that's what we see in Acts. The message starts in Jerusalem. It spreads. It goes to Samaria. And then it goes all the way to Rome by the end of the book. So that's what Luke's planning to do. And since he's planning to use Jerusalem as ground zero, he doesn't want to focus on a side tour to Galilee. And so he omits the Galilee bit, and instead he just records information that happened while they were there in Jerusalem. And it's here that he indicates where the ascension occurred, because Matthew doesn't mention the ascension.
I see.
Luke does. He gives a brief account of it at the end of his gospel, and then he explores it a little bit more in the first chapter of Acts. And what he indicates is that this happened on the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives is not in Galilee. Mm-hmm. It's in Judea. It's directly opposite Jerusalem across what's known as the Kidron Valley.
Okay.
So if you were standing, let's say, at the temple and looked east, you would see the Kidron Valley in front of you. And on the other side, you're just looking at the next hill. It's the Mount of Olives. And that's where Luke says the ascension happened. And in fact, if you go to the Mount of Olives today, there's a shrine. It's not a whole church, but up at a certain spot near the top, there's a shrine that commemorates the place of the ascension. It's kind of a circular tower that's open to the sky. It's open to heaven. You can go inside, and they even talk about what looks like a footprint on a rock that is, you know, commemorated as the place Jesus kind of touched off to ascend to heaven. So So the mountain that we see in Galilee is not being in Matthew is not being depicted as the one from which Jesus ascends in Acts and in Luke. Interestingly, some people have wondered, okay, well, so if Matthew and Mark have the resurrection encounters happening in Galilee and Luke has them happening in Judea, how do we square that? And actually, the answer is provided by the Gospel of John. He went both places. And in John, it records both resurrection appearances in Judea and in Galilee. Matthew, Mark, and Luke simply choose to focus on different ones.
More on the ascension and this idea that we'll get to how the Gospels end and then how the book of Acts starts when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Got questions? Visit us today at Catholic.com.
Hi, this is Jerry Usher reminding you to listen to Vocation Boom Radio Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Each week, I bring you dynamic interviews with bishops, priests, vocation directors, even seminarians and those who support them, all in an effort to assist the Holy Spirit in what is truly a vocation boom around the world. That's Vocation Boom Radio Saturdays at 5 p.m. Eastern, only on EWTN Radio.
Did you know you can book any of our great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
We've all heard the phrase, the new evangelization. In previous centuries, missionaries would travel to foreign lands to evangelize, but today's missionaries are more likely to focus on fallen away Catholic neighbors or relatives. But what about the old evangelization? The two millennia of Catholic missionary efforts by the likes of St. Paul, St. Augustine of Canterbury, St. Francis Xavier, and most importantly, our Lord Himself. We must not forget the methods they used to spread the faith to the farthest reaches of the world. Our situation may be new, but the essentials of evangelization always remain the same. In his new book, The Old Evangelization, How to Spread the Faith Like Jesus Did, author Eric Sammons provides a practical guide to putting these essentials into practice in everyday use in your interactions with family, friends, coworkers, and even fellow parishioners. Order your copy of The Old Evangelization today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. We are discussing the ascension of the Lord and all the things that kind of surround that moment that we celebrate today on the Feast of the Ascension. Jimmy, I wanted to get at, if I read the four Gospels and I get to the end of the four Gospels, mm-hmm. Other than Luke, who gives a kind of very, very brief
mention of the Ascension,
mm-hmm. John doesn't mention the Ascension, does he?
Well, not in his Gospel. Not at least he doesn't present it on camera in his Gospel. The one that, as far as I can think of passages, absolutely does not mention it is Matthew.
Yeah.
In Mark, it's there in the longer ending.
Right.
So it may or may not have been in the original ending, but if there was one, but it is there in the longer ending. In Luke, you get a brief account where Luke says that it happens at Bethany, which is on the Mount of Olives. And in John, he doesn't present it on camera, but he does refer to it. He mentions earlier on that, like, what if you were to see the Son of Man ascending to heaven?
Oh,
and
right.
Nobody can ascend to heaven except the man who came from heaven.
Right.
And then when he in the resurrection appearances, he's talking to Mary Magdalene, and she's so overjoyed to see him. She says that he says this thing that a lot of people have found very mysterious. He says to her, "Don't touch me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father." And you could also translate that, "Don't cling to me, mm-hmm. because I have not yet ascended to my Father." And I think that's what the real intended meaning here is. Mary's so overjoyed at having him back from the dead, she's thinking, oh, everything's great now, so he's just back and everything's going to be fine. But he's warning her, I'm going to ascend to my Father, so don't think you have me back forever. Don't be clingy, because I'm going to go away again.
Yeah.
And either way, whatever you interpret that to mean, he does refer to the fact he's going to ascend to his Father. And so you have a mention in one way or another in three of the four Gospels. And of course, it's also mentioned in Acts. It's explored there in its greatest depth. And it gets mentioned in multiple or alluded to in multiple other books of the New Testament, where you know it'll be mentioned that Jesus is in heaven, he's going to come back, he's sitting at the right hand of the Father, yeah. he's been raised up to heaven, all those things. Those are all different allusions to the ascension, and so this is just something that Christians universally knew about yeah. in the first century. It was part of the fundamental Christian message, and you know you would expect that because. Obviously, if you hear somebody's the Messiah and he worked all these miracles to prove it, and he got crucified and raised from the dead, you're going to want to meet him. And so, you know, this question would come up very naturally. Well, can I go meet him? Well, guess what? No, yeah. he's ascended to heaven,
right.
and so he's going to come back from there, and you can meet him then. Mm-hmm. You just need to be patient.
So these 40 days that he appears to people and that he visits, he's with the apostles, the disciples. How are those times with Jesus different than, say, he appears to a saint mm-hmm. later, you know, maybe visits with Saint Bernard, you know, centuries later?
Well, he's in his body, for one thing. Okay. Presumably, when Jesus appears to a saint, it's in a visionary form.
Uh-huh.
So he's not physically there. He's just appearing as a vision.
Okay. And then this physical presence, he doesn't – that ends with these 40 days with the exception of Paul?
Well, there's an interesting question about that.
Okay.
Historically, a lot of people have looked at what happened when Jesus appears to Paul and said, okay, this is kind of a little mini second coming, that Jesus was physically there. Mm-hmm. It is not clear from the text of the book of Acts that that's what happened. In fact, it talks about how other people who were there, they saw something, but they just saw a light. Mm-hmm. They didn't see Jesus. They heard something, but they couldn't understand what was being said. So there's some kind of physical manifestation happening. You might compare it, for example, say to the miracle of the sun at Fatima, where
yeah.
a bunch of people saw something. They didn't all see the vision, but they all saw something. And so it could be that's what's happening, but other people don't see Jesus there. And later on in Acts, Paul says, I was obedient to the heavenly vision.
Oh, yeah.
And so that could be taken as suggesting that this was a visionary experience. And the church doesn't have a definitive teaching on this. The catechism kind of skates along the edge, and its way of dealing with this, if you look in the section on the ascension, it says that Jesus appeared in a wholly unique way to St. Paul to appoint him as an apostle.
Okay.
But it doesn't specify what's unique about it. It doesn't say he physically came down from heaven, just that he had a unique encounter with Paul in which he appeared to him and made him an apostle.
So something then distinctly ended at the moment of his ascension.
Yeah.
And that's his physical sojourn on earth. Okay.
For now.
Yeah. Okay, so why? Why did he leave?
Well, in the Gospels, he talks about he's going to prepare a place for us
mm-hmm.
In heaven. And so he's doing that. He also, we know from other texts in the New Testament, he's interceding for us in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
He's serving as the high priest in heaven in the heavenly liturgy. So he's doing things in heaven. It's rather hard for us to process those because we haven't had the experience of heaven. It transcends really our ability to imagine in this life. And so these images that we have of him preparing a place for us, like either building rooms or getting rooms ready, like a carpenter,
yeah.
Or serving as a high priest in a liturgy, or interceding with us like a court official with a king, all of those are images that describe aspects of what he's doing, but exactly how that happens and exactly what it means is something that we can't really fully grasp in this life. There's also an element of mystery here, because God could have simply brought on the consummation of the world right at that point,
mm-hmm.
but he chose not to. And we get a hint of why in Paul's epistles, because in Romans, Paul talks about how there's been a hardening that's come on the Jewish people in part for a time while God brings the Gentiles into the sphere of his grace. And then once the full number of Gentiles have come in, all Israel will be saved. And so there'll be a conversion of the Jewish people, which Paul links to life from the dead. In other words, the general resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a sense that God is delaying the end of the world in order to allow a greater number of people to now come into being, to be born, and to be saved. And so presumably, Jesus being in heaven is related to that, because if Jesus had simply stayed on earth, well, if he'd stayed on earth in an unglorified state, you know, it would have been really strange. The Jewish authorities would not have been happy. They might have tried to crucify him all over again. And if he's not exercising his glory, if he's not performing miracles right and left to defend himself, then they could actually do that again. He made himself vulnerable the first time, unless he chose to say, use those 12 legions of angels he said the Father would give him if he wanted them to defend himself, then he would be vulnerable all over again. On the other hand, if he did use his miraculous powers and did invoke those 12 legions of angels, that would interfere rather significantly with the process that God wanted to play out of evangelization and gradual growth of the church and the conversion of people in the way that it has unfolded in our actual history. So even though God's omnipotent and could have done things very differently than he actually did, this is at least the way he chose to do it for us, and we can see some of the factors that seem to be related to that decision, but it's ultimately God's choice, not something that we can say, well, it had to be this way.
So why did he go up? Is heaven up there?
Yeah, well, so, you know, there's the famous story about the Russian cosmonaut who gets up into heaven, into space, and looks around and says, well, I don't see God. And that's based on a kind of naive understanding of what heaven is. Heaven is not, even though, okay, so I guess back up for a second. The word heaven in English and in other languages is the same as the word for sky. And in English, you know, we can talk about the angels of heaven or the stars of heaven.
Yeah.
And
right.
Either way, heaven is an old-fashioned word for the sky.
Right.
Today, it's more gravitated in English to refer to where God is, or is at where God is depicted as being. But originally, it was just the word for sky. And the same thing is true in the biblical languages. In Greek, the word for heaven and sky is uranos. In Hebrew, the word for heaven or sky is shmaim. And so the ancients identified the sky with heaven, and that was the place of God or the gods in polytheistic societies, or rather it was one of the places. There were other places too. So in addition to celestial deities that were depicted as living in the sky, there were also what were known as chthonic deities that lived under the earth, and there were like Hades in Greek, or Osiris, the lord of the underworld in Egypt. And there were also aquatic deities like Poseidon that lived in the ocean. And so what do all three of these places, the sky, the under the earth, and the ocean, what do they all have in common?
They're inaccessible to us.
That's it exactly. They're all places where humans don't live.
Yeah.
And so their fundamental kind of anthropological recognition that the divine exists outside of the realm of ordinary human experience.
I see.
It occasionally breaks through into ordinary human experience, but it's fundamentally outside of it. And that's one reason why when you want to make contact with the divine, going up on a mountain and getting close to the sky and perhaps fasting and changing your ordinary daily routine to get out of ordinary human experience and be closer to the divine is one of the things that we see happening in the Bible and in other cultures too, because getting up on a mountaintop, at least before the invention of the airplane, is about as close to the sky as you could get in the ancient world. And so it's an effort on humans, on the human side, to get close to the realm of the divine, at least metaphorically. Now, we understand that really God is not in outer space. And so when Jesus ascends, the natural way to understand that is this is God's way of showing us what fundamentally is happening here, which is Jesus is leaving the realm of ordinary earthly life and re-entering the sphere of the divine. And he's taking his body with him now, because originally he didn't have it when he came from there, when he was initially incarnate. His body was something that began in Mary's womb. But now that it's he's taken on a body, he's returning to the sphere of the divine with his body. And because of how the ancients, just based on human anthropology, the fact that we're designed to live on earth, they naturally understood the realm of the divine as outside of that. God shows us Jesus is re-entering the realm of the divine by raising him physically into the sky as a way of communicating the deeper message of what's happening here. So Jesus really did physically ascend into heaven, but that doesn't mean he zoomed off into outer space and is in outer space somewhere. This is an enactment that God is using to communicate a message to the first Christians in terms they would have already understood.
And is just real quick before we have to take a break, do you some people would say, well, it's something that Luke created to give it to let us understand.
Yeah, well, that's almost certainly wrong.
Yeah, okay. So that's what I wanted to get clear, that that Jesus, in the same way that he walked on the earth and he fed the 5,000, he did, in fact, bodily leave the earth. That's a historical fact.
Yes.
Okay. All right. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more on the Ascension with Jimmy Akin, our guest on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
The Jewish Sabbath or the Christian Sunday? What exactly is the Lord's Day? This is Tim Staples, and I'll give you the facts you need to know in the next issue of Catholic Answers Magazine. Want to be sure to get your copy? Subscribe right now to the best Catholic apologetics magazine anywhere by calling 888-291-8000 or going to Catholic.com. Jimmy Akin on evaluating claims in the Papal Rumor Net, Carlo Broussard on the likelihood of miracles, plus a very special look back at the history of the modern apologetics movement by our founder, Carl Keating. Just a few of the articles you can look forward to in our next issue. Don't wait another moment to subscribe. Call 888-291-8000 or go to the shop at Catholic.com right now to get subscriptions for yourself and those you love. Share the faith. Defend the faith. Catholic Answers Magazine. From Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to remind you about a very special event that you're going to want to save the date for. This September 28th to the 30th, we'll be hosting our fourth annual National Apologetics Conference here in beautiful San Diego. And this is one conference you're not going to want to miss. The theme is the reunion of all Christians, and we've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to fire you up. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf, apologist Mark Brumley, apologist Devin Rose, plus all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. For almost four decades, Catholic Answers has been engaging our separated brethren in charity to bring them to the fullness of the truth. Join us this September for a lively and inspiring conference designed to help you play an active part in the reunion of all Christians. We've got lower prices than ever before and a beautiful venue in San Diego, California. You don't want to miss it. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
And welcome back. Thanks again for being with us on this Ascension Thursday for Catholic Answers Live. And we're talking about the Ascension with Jimmy Akin. senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And when we were going to the break, you assured us that this is the ascension of Jesus is a historical fact, and that Luke is telling us the truth about what happened.
Luke didn't make it up.
Yeah, Luke. Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes people, and we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier in the show, but sometimes people who have a skeptical approach to the Bible will look at things and try to isolate them and sort of pretend that, like, if it's not mentioned in a gospel or a particular book, that author didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. And so there could be a tendency to look at Luke and say, well, so Luke's the only one who gives us on-camera depictions of the ascension, so he must have invented it. Well, no. So a couple of things. Let's think about the chronology here. Luke, now people date the book of Acts and the Gospel of Luke at different points in history. A common way of dating Luke in some scholarship is to say, well, Luke was probably written around the year 80 or 85 in the late first century. I think that's wrong. I think that that's a little bit too late. In fact, it's about 25 years too late. If you look at the ending of the book of Acts, it cuts off with Paul waiting trial in Rome for 2 years, the end.
Yeah.
And Luke has been building up to Paul's trial for like 7 chapters. It's a quarter of the whole book. And so it makes no sense dramatically to just stop writing at that point unless you don't know the outcome of Paul's trial. Mm-hmm. And so Luke was with him. You know, he's one of his traveling companions. And so it looks like the reason that that Luke stops writing at this point is because that's when he was writing the book of Acts. And so that takes us up to about AD 60, the end of Paul's first Roman imprisonment. And this is not just a view that is held by conservative scholars. Liberal scholars like the British scholar John A.T. Robinson or the German scholar Adolf von Harnack also agree with this. So it looks like Acts was written in around AD 60. Some would say 62, depending on when you date Paul's imprisonment. But I would say 60. And so my guess is in that 2-year window where he's awaiting trial in Rome, that's when both Luke and Acts got written. And we know they were written at this roughly the same time because of the way Luke ends, which we already touched on, the fact that it sets us up for Acts. The reason that Luke doesn't pick up on the Galilee stuff from Mark, which he was using as a source, the reason he doesn't pick up on that stuff is because he knows what his game plan for Acts is going to be, that he's going to use Jerusalem as ground zero for the gospel. And so it looks like the two books were written in close proximity. So I would say the Gospel of Luke was probably written in AD 59. The book of Acts was probably written in AD 60. Now, this is about not quite 30 years after the crucifixion. Some people would say it happened in AD 30. The more probable year is 33. So we're about 27 to 30 years after that. And so it's like the question of where is Jesus now never came up in that 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously this is not something that Luke is making up for the first time. We have it mentioned in Paul's, epistles, which were written in the 50s for the most part. Certainly his most famous epistles were written in the 50s. And he talks about Jesus ascending. He doesn't give us an on-camera presentation, but then he's not writing a historical narrative. He's writing theological letters and happens to allude to it. So we've got it mentioned there. Also, Luke tells us in the prologues to Luke and Acts what his sources were. He mentions that other people have already written accounts of what happened with Jesus. And he says that I've been tracking for a long time the things that have been handed down to us by the original eyewitnesses and the ministers of the word. Mm-hmm. So he's been talking to eyewitnesses and other authorized ministers like Paul. And so that's where Luke got the information that he uses in the end of his gospel and the beginning of Acts. He's not making it up. He got it from Tradens.
May I ask, possibly Peter himself was in Rome at the time?
Peter, well, yes, indeed. Peter was in Rome, and there's pretty good evidence that Peter is one of Luke's sources, because if you look in the book of Acts, there are other indications in the gospel as well, but if in particular in Acts, you really have the stories of two apostles with very few exceptions. The first 12 chapters of Acts are overwhelmingly devoted to Peter. You have a little bit of a detour in there for Philip, but even Peter comes into the end of that story. Mm-hmm. And then you have a little bit of a detour for Paul's conversion and a little bit of a detour for Stephen's martyrdom, which sets us up for Paul's conversion because that's when Paul gets introduced. But overwhelmingly, the first 12 chapters of Acts are devoted to Peter, and the remaining chapters 13 to 28, are all devoted to Paul. Mm-hmm. And so this suggests Luke had a lot of information mm-hmm. about these two apostles and not the others.
Yeah.
Because if he had lots of information about the others, he presumably would have fleshed out
where they went.
Yeah. Exactly. And that suggests, since we know he was in contact with Paul, because in Acts there are these "we" passages where suddenly he starts talking in the first person plural and says, "We went here and we did this." So he's identifying himself as a traveling companion of Paul. And he then gets to Rome with Paul. Guess what? There's all kinds of tradition saying that Peter spent an extended period of time in Rome as its first bishop. And that would explain where Luke got the information from the first 12 chapters of Acts, that he was getting it from Peter while he was in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
So during that same two-year window. And so we do have good evidence that he's getting this both from an eyewitness, Peter, and a minister of the word, Paul, and that's where this tradition is coming from. But if you think about it, the tradition of Jesus ascending had to go all the way back to AD 33. Because the question of, well, where is he then, would have been immediately asked.
Right, that's what you would ask. I mean, he rose from the dead. Oh,
yeah, okay,
where is
so
he?
let's talk to him. You know, I want to hear about this.
Yeah.
And so there's no way that question would not have been asked as soon as Christians first started preaching the resurrection. And consequently, this is a tradition they would have had to have an answer for, you know, for that question. So this is a tradition that goes all the way back to the very beginning.
And now, okay, so from that, then there are two men in white then.
Yeah.
Who appear.
Mm-hmm.
And they say to if Jesus just went up, everybody's standing looking up.
Right. So Jesus ascends. They're all looking up. The cloud cuts off Jesus from their vision.
Yeah.
And the two men in white appear.
And they tell them.
They say, "Men of Galilee, why are you standing up looking to the heaven with your mouths hanging open?"
Which is such a weird thing to say. Because Jesus, like, how did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And these are the men in white is assembled. These are angels appearing in human form. And perhaps even the same two angels that appeared at the empty tomb.
Yeah.
Because there were the two angels, two men in white there. So the angels tell them, don't bother looking up in the sky anymore, but Jesus will return in the same way he left. So they point the disciples forward to the second coming.
Okay. So that's, I guess, where I wanted to end. Mm-hmm. That Christ was really born, really died, really raised, really ascended. And so they're telling us a historical fact.
Yeah.
That is in fact the case. He will physically come again.
He will come again. And when he does, we'll be like him. So we're going to get the same kind of upgrade.
I'm looking forward to that, especially as I age.
Yeah.
I need the upgrade. Jimmy Akin, thank you very, very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Si.
To discuss the ascension, and a blessed ascension to all of you. Whether it is a holy day of obligation where you are or not, well, at least on Sunday, you'll celebrate the Ascension. And I hope this reflection on the Ascension will help you in that celebration. Coming up next, Paul Kengor, author of The Pope and the President, will be here to fill us in on the history of Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II working together. We'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.